clicks of hammers striking chisel, and chisel striking stone. At other times, the broader silence and desolation became oppressive, especially after the crow moved on. They were uncomfortably aware of the silence. And Sternberg had been right. In the end, the worst thing about the Badlands was the dust. Harshly alkaline, it billowed up with every stab of pick and shovel. It burned the eyes, stung the nose, caked the mouth, caused coughing spasms. It burned in open cuts. It covered clothes and chafed at elbows and armpits and backs of knees. It gritted in sleeping bags. It dusted food, sour and bitter, and flavored coffee. Stirred by the wind, it became a constant force, a signature of this harsh and forbidding place. Their hands, which they needed in order to do everything, especially dig fossils, were soon scraped and calloused, the dust burning in any cracks. Cope insisted they thoroughly wash their hands at the end of the day and dispensed a small dollop of yellowish emollient to rub into their palms and fingers. "Smells bad," Johnson said. "What is it?" "Clarified bear fat." But the dust was everywhere. Nothing they tried worked. Bandanas and face cloths did not help, since they could not protect the eyes. Cookie built a tent to try to keep the dust off the food he was preparing, but it burned down on the second day. They complained to each other for a while, and then after the second week, they no longer mentioned it. It was like a conspiracy of silence. They would no longer talk about the dust. Once dug out, the fragile bones had to be lowered down with ropes in a difficult, painstaking process. One slip, and the fossils would break free of the ropes and tumble down the hillside, crashing to the ground, smashed beyond value. At such times, Cope turned waspish, reminding them that the fossils had lain for millions of years in perfect peace and remarkable preservation, waiting for you to drop them like idiots. Idiots! These hot speeches led them to anxiously await some slip by Cope himself. But it never happened. Sternberg finally said that, except for his temper, the professor is perfect, and it seems best to recognize it. But the rock was fragile, and breaks in the fossils did occur, even with the most careful handling. Most frustrating of all was a break days or weeks after the fossil was lowered to the ground. It was Sternberg who first proposed a solution. When they set out from Fort Benton, they had brought with them several hundred pounds of rice. As the days went on, it became clear that they would never eat all the rice. "At least not the way Stinky cooks it," Isaac grumbled. Rather than leave it behind, Sternberg boiled the rice to a gelatinous paste, which he poured over the fossils. This novel preservative technique left the fossils looking like snowy blocks, or as he put it, gigantic cookies. But whatever they called it, the paste provided a protective covering. They had no further breaks. Around the Fire. Each evening, when the sunlight was fading and the light was soft, making the sculptured terrain look less stark, Cope reviewed with them the finds of the day, and spoke of the lost world in which these giant animals roamed. Cope could speak like an orator when he chose to, noted Sternberg, and of an evening, the dead gray rocks became dense green jungle. The trickling streams, vast vegetation-choked lakes, the clear sky turned close with hot rain clouds, and indeed the entire barren landscape before our eyes was transformed into an ancient swamp. It was mysterious when he spoke that way. We felt goosebumps and a chill on the spine. In part, that chill came from the lingering tinge of heresy. Unlike Marsh, Cope was not an open Darwinian, but he appeared to believe in evolution, and certainly in great antiquity. Morton was going to be a preacher like his father. He asked Cope, as a man of science, how old the world was. Cope said he had no idea, in the mild way he had when he was concealing something. It was the opposite side of his snapping temper, this almost lazy indifference, this tranquil, calm voice. This mildness overcame Cope whenever the discussion moved into areas that might be considered religious. A devout Quaker, despite his pugilistic temperament, he found it difficult to tread on the religious feelings of others. Was the world, Morton asked, 6,000 years old, as Bishop Usher had said? A great many serious and informed people still believed this date, despite Darwin and the fuss that the new scientists who called themselves geologists were making. After all, the trouble with what the scientists said was that they were always saying something different. This year one idea, next year something else. Scientific opinion was ever-changing, like the fashions of women's dress, while the firm and fixed date 4004 BC invited the attention of those seeking greater verity. No, Cope said. He did not think the world was so recent. How old, then? Asked Morton. 6,000 years? 10,000 years? No, Cope said, still tranquil. Then how much older? 1,000,000 times as old, said Cope, his voice still dreamy. Surely you're joking, Morton exclaimed. 4 billion years? That is patently absurd. I know of no one who was there at the time, Cope said mildly. But what about the age of the sun? Morton said, with a smug look. In 1871, Lord Kelvin, the most eminent physicist of his day, posed a serious objection to Darwin's theory. It had not been answered by Darwin, or anyone else in subsequent years. Whatever else one might think of evolutionary theory, it obviously implied a substantial period of time, at least several 100,000 years, to carry out its effects on Earth. At the time of Darwin's publication, the oldest estimates of the age of the Earth were around 10,000 years. Darwin himself believed the Earth would have to be at least 300,000 years old to allow enough time for evolution. The earthly evidence, from the new study of geology, was confusing and contradictory, but it seemed at least conceivable that the Earth might be several 100,000 years old. Lord Kelvin took a different approach to the question. He asked how long the sun had been burning. At this time, the mass of the sun was well established. It was obviously burning with the same processes of combustion as were found on Earth. Therefore, one could estimate the time it would take to consume the mass of the sun in a great fire. Kelvin's answer was that the sun would burn up entirely within 20,000 years. The fact that Lord Kelvin was a devoutly religious man and therefore opposed to evolution could not be thought to have biased his thinking. He had investigated the problem from the impersonal vantage point of mathematics and physics. And he had concluded, irrefutably, that there was simply not enough time for evolutionary processes to take place. Corroborating evidence derived from the warmth of the Earth. From mine shafts and other drilling, it was known that the Earth's temperature increased 1 degree for every 1,000 feet of depth. This implied that the core of the Earth was still quite hot. But if the Earth had really formed hundreds of thousands of years ago, it would have long since become cool. That was a clear implication of the second law of thermodynamics, and there was no disputing it. There was only one escape from these physical dilemmas, and Cope echoed Darwin in suggesting it. Perhaps, he said, we do not know everything about the energy sources of the sun and the Earth. You mean there may be a new form of energy as yet unknown to science? Morton asked. The physicists say that it is impossible, that the rules governing the universe are fully understood by them. Perhaps the physicists are wrong, Cope said. Certainly someone is wrong. That is true, Cope said evenly. If he was open-minded when listening to Morton's beliefs, he was equally so with Little Wind, the Snake Scout. Early in the bone digging, Little Wind became agitated and objected to their excavations. He said they would all be killed. "Who will kill us?" Sternberg inquired. "The Great Spirit, with lightning." "Why?" Sternberg asked. "Because we disturb the burial ground." Little Wind explained that these were the bones of giant snakes that had inhabited the earth in ages past, before the Great Spirit had hunted them down and killed them all with bolts of lightning, so that man could live on the plains. The Great Spirit would not want the serpent bones disturbed, and would not look kindly on their adventures. Sternberg, who did not like Little Wind anyway, duly reported it to Cope. "He may be right," Cope said. "It's nothing but savage superstition," Sternberg snorted. "Superstition? Which part do you mean?" "All of it," Sternberg said. "The very idea." Cope said, "The Indians think these fossils are the bones of serpents, which is to say reptiles. We think they were reptiles too. They think these creatures were gigantic. So do we. They think these gigantic reptiles lived in the distant past. So do we. They think the Great Spirit killed them. We say we don't know why they disappeared. But since we offer no explanation of our own, how can we be sure theirs is superstition?" Sternberg walked away, shaking his head. Bad Water. Cope chose his campsites for convenience to fossils, and no other reason. One difficulty with their first site was lack of water. Nearby Bear Creek was so badly polluted they did not draw water from there after the first night, when they all experienced dysentery and cramps, and the water elsewhere in the Badlands was, in Sternberg's words, like a dense solution of Epsom salts. So they drew all their water from springs. Little Wind knew several, the nearest a 2-mile ride from camp. Since Johnson was fussiest about the water, which he used for his photographic processes, it became his job to ride to and from the spring each day and fetch the water. Someone always accompanied him on these excursions. They had seen no trouble with the Crows, and the Sioux were still presumed to be far south. But these were Indian hunting grounds, and they never knew when they might meet small parties of hostile Indians. Solitary riders were always at risk. Nevertheless, for Johnson it was the most exhilarating part of the day, to ride out under the great dome of blue sky, with the plains stretching in all directions around him, was an experience that approached the mystical. Usually Little Wind rode with him. Little Wind liked to get out of camp too, but for different reasons. As the days passed and more bones were unearthed, he became increasingly fearful of the retribution of the Great Spirit, or as he sometimes called it, the Everywhere Spirit, the spirit that existed in all things in the world, and was found everywhere. They would usually arrive at the spring, located in Flat Prairie, around 3 in the afternoon, as the sun was cooling and the light turning yellow. They filled their water bags and slung them onto the horses, and paused to drink directly from the stream, and then rode back. One day as they reached the spring, Little Wind gestured for Johnson to stay some distance away, while he dismounted and inspected the ground around the spring closely. "What is it?" Johnson said. Little Wind was moving quickly all around the spring, his nose inches from the ground. Occasionally he picked up a clod of prairie sod, smelled it, and dropped it again. This behavior always filled Johnson with a mixture of amazement and irritation. Amazement that an Indian could read the land as he read a book, and irritation because he could not learn to do it himself. And he suspected that Little Wind, knowing this, added a theatrical touch to his procedures. "What is it?" Johnson asked again, annoyed. "Horses," Little Wind said. "Two horses, two men. This morning."
"Indians?"
The word came out more nervously than he had intended. Little Wind shook his head. Horses have shoes. Men have boots. They had seen no white men for nearly a month, except their own party. There was little reason for white men to be here. Johnson frowned. Trappers? What trappers? Little Wind gestured to the flat expanse of the plains in all directions. Nothing to trap. Buffalo hunters? There was still a trade in buffalo hides, which were fashioned into robes for sale in the cities. Little Wind shook his head. Buffalo men don't hunt on Sioux land. That was true, Johnson thought. To invade the Sioux lands looking for gold was one thing, but buffalo hunters would never take the risk. Then, who are they? Same men. What same men? Same men at Dog Creek. Johnson dismounted. The same men whose camp you found back at Dog Creek? How do you know that? Little Wind pointed in the mud. This one boot crack heel. Same heel. Same man. I'll be damned, Johnson said. We're being followed. Yes. Well, he said, let's get the water and tell Cope. Maybe he'll want to do something. No use water here. Little Wind pointed to the horses, which were standing quietly by the spring. I don't get it, Johnson said. Horses no drink, Little Wind said. The horses always drank as soon as they reached the spring. That was the first thing they did. Let the horses drink before they filled their water bags. But Little Wind was right. Today the horses were not drinking. I'll be, Johnson said. Water not go good, Little Wind said. He bent close to the water and sniffed. Suddenly he plunged his hand up to his shoulder into the spring and pulled out great clumps of a pale green grass. He reached in again, pulled out more. With each clump he removed, the spring flowed more freely. He named the weed for Johnson and explained that it would cause sickness if men drank it. Little Wind was speaking quickly, and Johnson did not understand it all, except that apparently it caused fevers and vomiting, and men acted crazy if they didn't die. Bad thing, he said. Tomorrow, water is good. He stared off across the plains. We go find those white men? Johnson said. I go, Little Wind said. Me too, Johnson said. They rode at a gallop for nearly an hour in the yellowing afternoon light, and soon they were far from camp. It would be difficult, Johnson realized, to make it back by nightfall. Periodically, Little Wind would pause, dismount, check the ground, and mount up again. How much farther? Soon. They rode on. The sun dropped behind the peaks of the Rockies, and still they rode. Johnson began to worry. He had never been out on the plains at night before, and Cope had repeatedly warned him always to return to camp before dark. How much farther? Soon. They rode for perhaps 15 minutes more, and stopped again. Little Wind seemed to be stopping more often. Johnson thought it was because it was too dark to see the ground clearly. How much farther? You won't go back. Me? No, I was just asking how much farther. Little Wind smiled. Get dark. You afraid. Don't be ridiculous. I was just asking. Is it much farther, do you think? No, Little Wind said. He pointed. There. Beyond a far ridge, they saw a thin line of gray smoke climbing straight into the sky. A campfire. Leave horses, Little Wind said, dismounting. He pulled up a bunch of grass, let the blades fall in the wind. They drifted south. Little Wind nodded and explained that they must approach the camp downwind, or the other men's horses would smell them. They crept forward over the next ridge, lay on their stomachs, and looked down into the valley below. In the deepening twilight, two men, a tent, a glowing fire, six horses picketed behind the tent. One of the men was stocky, the other tall. They were cooking an antelope they had killed. Johnson could not see their faces well. But he found the sight of this solitary camp, surrounded in all directions by miles of open plains, oddly disturbing. Why were they here? These men want bones, Little Wind said, echoing his own thoughts. And then the tall man leaned close to the fire as he adjusted the leg on the spit, and Johnson saw a face he knew. It was the tough man he had spoken to in the Omaha train station, the man Marsh had spoken to near the cornfields, Navy Joe Benedict. And then they heard a murmuring voice. The tent flap opened, and a balding, heavy-set man emerged. He was rubbing something in his hands. Spectacles he was cleaning. The man spoke again, and even from a distance Johnson recognized the slight halt, the formality of the speech. It was Marsh. Cope clapped his hands in delight. So, the learned professor of copiology has followed us here. What better proof of what I have been saying? The man is not a scientist. He is a dog in the manger. He does not pursue his own discoveries. He seeks to spy on mine. I have neither time nor inclination to spy on him. But Daddy Marsh can come all the way from Yale College to the territory of Montana just to keep track of me. He shook his head. The asylum will yet receive him. You seem amused, Professor, Johnson said. Of course I am amused. Not only is my theory of the man's dementia amply confirmed, but so long as he is tracking me, he cannot be finding any new bones of his own. I doubt that follows, Sternberg said soberly. Marsh has nothing if not money, and his students are not with him. He is probably paying his bone hunters to dig for him simultaneously in three or four territories, even as we speak. Sternberg had done some work for Marsh several years before in Kansas. He was undoubtedly right. And Cope stopped, smiling. Speaking of finds, Cookie said, how did he find us? Little Wind said that these are the same men that were following us back at Dog Creek. Isaac leapt up. See? I told you we were being followed. Sit down, J.C., Cope said. He was frowning now. His good humor vanished. What are they doing here anyway? Cookie said. They're not on the square. They're gonna kill us and take the bones. They're not going to kill us, Cope said. Well, then take the bones for sure. They wouldn't dare. Even Marsh wouldn't dare. But in the darkness of the plains, he sounded unconvinced. There was a silence. They listened to the moan of the night wind. They poisoned the water, Johnson said. Yes, Cope said. They did. I wouldn't call that neighborly, Cookie said. True. You've made some important discoveries, Professor. Discoveries any scientist would give his left arm to claim as his own. True. There was another long silence. We surely are a long way from home out here, Isaac said. If something happened to us, who'd be the wiser? They'd just blame the Indians if we never showed back in Fort Benton. They blame Indians. Little Wind nodded. Quite true. Better do something about them, Isaac said. You're right, Cope said finally. He stared at the campfire. We will do something. We will invite them to dinner tomorrow night. Dinner with Cope and Marsh. The search for fossils was abandoned the next day in feverish preparation for Marsh. The camp was cleaned, clothes and bodies washed. Sternberg shot a deer for dinner, and Cookie roasted it. Cope was busy with preparations of his own. He picked through the piles of fossils they had found, selecting a piece here, a piece there, setting them aside. Johnson asked if he could help, but Cope shook his head. This is a job for an expert. You are selecting finds to show Marsh? In a way. I am making a new creature. Dinosaurus Marchiensis vulgaris. By the end of the day, he had assembled from fragments a passable skull, with two horned projections that stuck out laterally from the jaw like curving tusks. Isaac said it looked like a wild boar or a warthog. Exactly, Cope said, excited. A prehistoric porcine giant. A pig-like dinosaur. A pig for a pig. It's nice, Sternberg allowed. But it won't stand close scrutiny from Marsh. It won't have to. Cope ordered them to lift the skull, which was held together with paste, and under his instructions, they moved it first farther from the fire, then closer, then farther again, next to one side, and to another. Cope stood by the fire, squinted, and then ordered it moved again. He's like a woman decorating his house. And we're moving the furniture, Cookie said, panting. It was late afternoon when Cope pronounced himself satisfied with the skull's position. They all went off to clean up, and Little Wind was dispatched to invite the other camp to join them for dinner. He returned a few minutes later to say that three riders were approaching the camp. Cope smiled grimly. I should have known he'd invite himself. There was a theatrical aspect to both men, observed Sternberg, who had worked for both, although it manifested differently. Professor Marsh was heavy and solemn, a man of judicious pauses. He spoke slowly and had a way of making the listener hang on his next words. Professor Cope was the opposite. His words came in a tumbling rush, his movements were quick and nervous, and he captivated attention as a hummingbird does. So brilliantly quick you did not want to miss anything. At this meeting, the only face-to-face encounter I ever witnessed, it was clear no love was lost between them, though they were at pains to hide this fact in frosty Eastern formality. To what do we owe this honor, Professor Marsh? Cope asked when the three men had ridden into camp and dismounted. A social visit, Professor Cope, Marsh said. We happened to be in the neighborhood. Quite extraordinary, Professor Marsh, considering how large a neighborhood it is. Similar interests, Professor Cope, lead down similar paths. I am astonished you even knew we were here. We didn't know, Marsh said, but we saw your cook fire and came to investigate. Your attention honors us, Cope said. You must stay to dinner, of course. We have no wish to intrude, Marsh said, his eyes darting around the camp. And likewise, I am sure we have no wish to detain you on your journey, since you insist. We will be delighted to stay to dinner, Professor Cope. We accept with gratitude. Cookie produced some decent bourbon. As they drank, Marsh continued to look around the camp. His gaze fell on several fossils, and at length, the unusual tusked skull set off to one side. His eyes widened. I see you were looking around, Cope began. No, no. Ours must strike you as a very small expedition, compared to the grand scale of your own endeavors. Your outfit appears efficient and compact. We have been fortunate to make one or two significant finds. I'm certain you have, Marsh said. He spilled his bourbon nervously and wiped his chin with the heel of his hand. As one colleague to another, perhaps you'd enjoy a tour of our little camp, Professor Marsh. Marsh's excitement was palpable, but all he said was, Oh, I don't want to pry. I can't tempt you. I wouldn't want to be accused of anything improper, Marsh said, smiling. On second thought, Cope said, you are correct as always. Let's forego a tour and simply have dinner. In that instant, Marsh shot him a look of such murderous hatred that it chilled Johnson to see it. "More whiskey?" Cope asked. "Yes. I will have more," Marsh said, and he extended his glass. Dinner was a comedy of diplomacy. Marsh reminded Cope of the details of their past friendship, which had begun, of course, in Berlin, of all places, when both men were much younger and the Civil War raged. Cope hastened to add his own warm, confirming anecdotes. They fell all over each other in eagerness to declare their fervent admiration for one another. "Professor Cope has probably told you how I got him his first job," Marsh said. They demurred politely. They had not heard. "Well, not quite his first job," Marsh said. "Professor Cope had quit his position as zoology professor at Haverford. Quit rather suddenly, as I recall, and in 1868 he was looking to go west. True, Professor Cope?" "True, Professor Marsh. So I took him down to Washington to meet Ferdinand Hayden, who was planning the Geological Survey expedition. He and Hayden liked each other, and Professor Cope signed on as expedition paleontologist." "Very true." "Though you never actually accompanied the expedition, I believe," Marsh said. "No," Cope said. "My baby daughter was ill, and my own health not excellent. So I worked from Philadelphia, cataloging the bones the expedition sent back." "You have the most extraordinary ability to draw deductions from bones, without benefit of having seen them in the actual site, or having dug them out yourself." Marsh managed to turn this compliment into an insult. "You are no less talented in just that way, Professor Marsh," Cope said quickly. "I often wish I had, like you, the ample funds from multiple patrons needed to pay for the large network of bone hunters and fossil scouts you employ. It must be difficult for you to keep up with the quantities of bones sent you in New Haven, and to write all the papers yourself." "A problem you face as well," Marsh said. "I am amazed you are no more than a year behind in your own reporting. You must often be obliged to work with great haste." "With great speed, certainly," Cope said. "You always had a facile ability," Marsh said, and he then reminisced about some weeks they had spent as young men in Haddonfield, New Jersey, searching for fossils together. "Those were great times," he said, beaming. "Of course, we were younger then, and didn't know what we know now." "But even then," Marsh said, "I remember that if we found a fossil, I was obliged to ponder it for days to deduce its meaning, whereas Professor Cope would simply glance at it, snap his fingers, and give it a name. An impressive display of erudition, despite the occasional error." "I recall no errors," Cope said, "though in the years since then, you have been kind enough to hunt down all my errors and point them out to me. Science is an exacting mistress, demanding truth above all. For myself, I've always felt that truth is a byproduct of a man's character. An honest man will reveal the truth with every breath he takes, while a dishonest man will distort in the same way. More whiskey?" "I believe I'll have water," Marsh said. Navy Joe Benedict, sitting by his side, nudged him. "On second thought, whiskey sounds good."
"You don't want water?"
"The water in the Badlands doesn't always agree with me. That's why we draw ours from a spring. Anyway, you were saying, Professor Marsh, about honesty."
"No, I believe honesty was your subject, Professor Cope."
Johnson later recorded, "Our fascination at seeing these legendary giants of paleontological science meet head to head eventually faded as the evening grew older. It was of interest to note how long they had known each other, and how similar were their backgrounds. Both men had lost their mothers in infancy and had been raised by strict fathers. Both men had evinced a fascination with fossils from early childhood, a fascination that their fathers had opposed. Both men were difficult, lonely personalities. Marsh, because he had grown up on a rural farm,
cope because he had been a childhood prodigy who made anatomical notes at the age of 6. Both men had followed parallel careers, such that they met in Europe, where they were both abroad studying the fossils of the continent. At that time, they had been good friends, and now were implacable enemies. As the hours passed, interest in their banter faded. We were tired from the exertions of the day and ready for sleep. On Marsh's side, his roughneck companions looked equally fatigued, and still Cope and Marsh talked on into the night, sniping, bickering, trading insults as pleasantries. Finally, Toad fell asleep beside the fire. His loud snores were inescapable proof that these two had lost their audience, and having lost the audience to witness their jibes, they seemed to lose interest in each other. The evening had dragged to a seemingly undramatic conclusion. No hollering, no gunfire, and too much had been drunk on all sides. Marsh and Cope shook hands, but I noticed that the handshake was extended. One man was holding the other's hand tightly, not releasing it, as the two men stared hatefully into each other's eyes, the light from the fire flickering over both their faces. I could not tell which man was the aggressor in this instant, but I could plainly see each man silently swearing his undying enmity toward the other. Then the handshake broke off almost violently, and Marsh and his men rode off into the night.
Sleep with your guns tonight, boys. No sooner were they gone over the nearest ridge than Cope was wide awake, alert and energized. Break out your guns, he said. Sleep with your guns tonight, boys.
Why? What do you mean?
We'll have visitors tonight, mark my words. Cope bunched his fists in his pugilistic way. That vertebrate vulgarity will be back, crawling in on his belly like a snake for a closer look at my pig skull.
You don't mean to shoot at them, Isaac said, horrified.
I do, Cope said. They have opposed us and impeded us. They have got the army after us. They have poisoned our water and insulted our persons, and now they are going to steal our finds. Yes, I mean to shoot at them. This seemed to them extreme, but Cope was angry and would not be talked out of it. An hour passed. Most of the camp fell asleep. Johnson was lying next to Cope, and his twisting and turning kept him awake. Thus he was awake when the first dark figure crept over the ridge. Cope gave a soft sigh. A second figure, then a third. The third was heavyset, lumbering. Cope sighed again and swung his rifle around. The figures crept toward the camp and made for the fossil head. Cope raised his rifle to shoot. He was a crack shot, and for a horrified moment Johnson thought he really intended to kill his rival.
Now, Professor Johnson, he said quietly, I have him in my sights. It is within my power to kill a trespassing sneak and thief. Remember this night.
And Cope raised his rifle higher into the air and fired twice at the sky and shouted, Indians! Indians! The cry brought the camp to its feet. Soon rifles were discharged from all sides. The night air was clouded with gun smoke and acrid with the smell of powder. Across the camp, they heard the intruders scrambling up the ridge. There was an occasional shout of, Damn you! Damn your eyes! Finally, a deep, distinctive voice cried, Just your way, Cope! It's a damnable fake! Just your way! A fake! And the three men were gone. The firing stopped. I believe we have seen the last of Othie Marsh, Cope said. Smiling, he rolled over to sleep. Moving Camp. In early August, they were visited by a party of soldiers passing through the Badlands on their way to the Missouri River. Steamboats came as far upriver as Cow Island, where the army maintained a small camp. The soldiers were on their way to reinforce the garrison there.
They were young Irish and German boys, no older than the students, and they seemed amazed to find white men alive in the region. "I surely would pull out of here," one said. They brought news of the war, and it was not good. Custer's defeat was still unavenged. General Crook had fought an inconclusive battle at the Powder River in Wyoming, but had seen no Indians since. General Terry had not engaged any large parties of Sioux at all. The war, which the Eastern newspapers had confidently predicted would be over in a matter of weeks, appeared now to be dragging on indefinitely. Some generals were predicting that it would not be resolved for at least a year, and perhaps not even by the end of the decade.
"Trouble with Indians," one soldier explained, "is when they want to find you, they find you. And when they don't want you to find them, you'd never know they were there." He paused. "It is their country, after all. But I didn't say it."
Another soldier looked at their stacked crates.
"You mining here?"
"No," Johnson said. "These are bones. We're digging fossil bones."
"Sure you are," the soldier said, grinning broadly. He offered Johnson a drink from his canteen, which was filled with bourbon. Johnson gasped. The soldier laughed.
"Makes the miles shorter, I can tell you," he explained. The soldiers grazed their horses for an hour with Cope's party, and then went on.
"I surely wouldn't dawdle here much longer," their Captain Lawson said. "Best we know, Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, and his Sioux will make for Canada before winter, which means they'll be here any day now. They find you here, they'll kill you for sure."
And with that final advice, he rode off. Much later, Johnson heard that when Sitting Bull went north, he killed all the white men he came across, among them the troops stationed at Cow Island, including Captain Lawson.
"I think we ought to be going," Isaac said, scratching his chin.
"Not yet," Cope said.
"We've found plenty of bones."
"That's so," Cookie said. "Plenty so far. More'n enough."
"Not yet," Cope said, in an icy tone that ended all discussion. As Sternberg noted in his account of the expedition, "We had long since learned there was no purpose served in arguing with him when his mind was made up." Cope's indomitable will could not be conquered. But Cope did decide to break camp and move to another location. For the last 3 weeks, they had been located at the foot of 1,000-foot-high shale cliffs. He had been scouting the area, and he felt there was a more promising fossil location 3 miles distant.
"Where?" Sternberg said.
Cope pointed. "Up on the plains."
"You mean on the flat tablelands?"
"That's right."
Isaac protested. "But Professor, it'll take 3 days to move out of the Badlands, find a new route, and come back in up there."
"No, it won't."
"We can't scale these cliffs."
"Yes, we can.
A man can't walk up, a horse can't ride up, and certainly this wagon can't be pulled up those cliffs, Professor."
"Yes, it can. I will show you."
Cope insisted they pack up at once and moved 2 miles to the east, where he proudly pointed to a sloping bank of shale. It was much gentler than the surrounding cliffs, but still far too steep to negotiate. While there were some level ridges, the shale was loose and crumbling, affording treacherous footing. Cookie, the teamster, looked at the proposed route and spat tobacco.
"Can't be done. Can't be done."
"It can," Cope said, "and it will." It took them 14 hours to climb 1,000 feet. Back-breaking work, and continuously dangerous. Using shovels and picks, they dug a trail up the side. Then they unloaded the wagon and put everything they could on the horses and got the horses up. Now only the wagon remained. Cookie drove it halfway up the incline from the floor below, but when he arrived at a level ridge so narrow that one wheel was hanging over empty space, he refused to go any farther. This enraged Cope, who said he would drive the wagon himself.
"Not only are you a revolting cook, but you are a wretched teamster."
The others quickly interceded, and Isaac climbed on to drive the wagon. They had to unhitch the lead horses, and pull the wagon with the remaining two ponies. Sternberg later described it in The Life of a Fossil Hunter. Isaac had driven about 30 feet when the inevitable happened. I saw the wagon slowly begin to tip, pulling the ponies over sideways, and then the whole outfit, wagon and horses, began to roll down the slope. Whenever the wheels stuck up in the air, the ponies drew in their feet to their bellies, and at the next turn, stretched out their legs for another roll. My heart was in my mouth for fear that Isaac would be killed in one of the turns, or that the wagon would roll over the precipice below. But after 3 complete turns, they landed, the horses on their feet, the wagon on its wheels, on a level edge of sandstone, and stood there as if nothing had happened. Eventually they unhitched all the horses and pulled the wagon up on ropes. But they succeeded, and late in the day they made camp on the prairie. Cope snapped at Cookie, "This dinner better be your best." "Just wait and see," Cookie said. And he served them the usual fare of hardtack, bacon, and beans. Despite the grumbling, their new camp was a decided improvement. The breeze made it cooler, for they were on the open plains, wrote Johnson, with a magnificent view of mountains in every direction. To the west, the towering craggy Rockies, with white snow gleaming on their peaks. To the south, east, and north, the Judith River, Medicine Bow, Bear Paw, and Sweetgrass Mountains, completely encircling us. Especially in the early morning, when the air was clear and we could see herds of deer and elk and antelope and the mountains beyond, it was a sight of such glory as surely cannot be matched elsewhere in all creation. But the herds of deer and antelope were migrating northward, and the snow was creeping down the slopes of the Rockies as the days passed. One morning they awoke to find a thin carpet of snow had fallen during the night, and although it burned off by midday, they could not ignore the inevitable fact. The seasons were changing. Fall was coming. And with the fall, the Sioux. "It's time to leave, Professor." "Not yet," Cope said. "Not just yet." The Teeth. One afternoon, Johnson came across some knobby protuberances of rock, each roughly the size of a fist. He was working in a promising deposit midway up the side of a shale slope, and these knobs got in his way. He pulled several out of the exposed surface, and they tumbled down the hillside, narrowly missing Cope, who was at the base of the cliffs, sketching a newly discovered Allosaurus leg bone. Cope heard them coming and took a practiced step to the side. "Hey there!" he shouted up the slope. "Sorry, Professor," Johnson called sheepishly. One or two rocks continued to fall. Cope moved aside again the other way and dusted himself off. "Be careful!" "Yes, sir. Sorry," Johnson repeated. Gingerly he returned to his work, digging with his pick around still other rocks, trying to pry them free and... "Stop!" Johnson looked down. Cope was scrambling up the hillside toward him like a madman, one of the fallen rocks in each hand. "Stop! Stop, I say!" "I'm being careful," Johnson protested. "Really, I..." "Wait!" Cope slid several yards down the slope. "Do nothing! Touch nothing!" Still shouting, he slid backwards, disappearing in a dust cloud. Johnson waited. After a moment, he saw Professor Cope scrambling out of the dust, coming up the hill with frenzied energy. Johnson thought he must be very angry. It was foolish and nearly impossible to climb straight up the hill. They had all learned that long ago. The surface was too sheer and too friable. A climber had to zigzag his way up, and even that was so difficult they usually preferred a detour of as much as a mile to find an easy route to the top, and from there to descend to where they wanted to go. Yet here was Cope, scrambling straight up as if his life depended upon doing so. "Wait!" "I'm waiting, Professor." "Don't do anything!" "I'm not doing anything, Professor." At length, Cope arrived beside him, covered in dirt, gasping for breath. But he did not hesitate. He wiped his face with his sleeve and peered at the excavation. "Where is your camera?"
he demanded. Why don't you have your camera? I want a picture in situ.
Of these rocks? Johnson asked, astonished.
Rocks? You think these are rocks? They are nothing of the sort.
Then what are they?
They are teeth, Cope exclaimed.
Cope touched one and traced with his finger the gentle hills and indentations of the cusp pattern. He placed the two he held next to each other, then found a third at Johnson's feet and set it in a row with the other two. It was clear from their similarity in size and form that they went together.
Teeth, he repeated. Dinosaur teeth.
But they are enormous. This dinosaur must be of fantastic size.
For a moment, the two men silently contemplated just how large such a dinosaur must have been. The jaw needed to hold rows of such large teeth. The thick skull needed to match such a massive jaw. The enormous neck, the width of a stout oak, to lift and move such a skull and jaw. The gigantic backbone commensurate to the neck, with each vertebra as big around as a wagon wheel, with four staggeringly huge and thick legs to support such a beast. Each tooth implied an enormity of every bone and every joint. An animal that large might even need a long tail to counterweight its neck, in fact. Cope stared across the rocky expanse and beyond, into his own imagination and knowledge. For a moment, his usual ferocious confidence gave way to quiet wonder. The full creature must be at least twice the dimensions of any previously known, he said, almost to himself. They had already made several discoveries of large dinosaurs, including three examples of the genus Monoclonius, a horned dinosaur that resembled a gigantic rhinoceros. Monoclonius sphenoceros, one of the specimens, was estimated by Cope to stand 7 feet tall at the hip joint and to be 25 feet long, including the tail. Yet this new dinosaur was far larger than that. Cope measured the teeth with his steel calipers, scratched some calculations on his sketchpad, and shook his head. It doesn't seem possible, he said, and measured again. And then he stood looking across the expanses of rock, as if expecting to see the giant dinosaur appear before him, shaking the ground with each step. If we are making discoveries such as this one, he said to Johnson, it means that we have barely scratched what is possible to learn. You and I are the first men in recorded history to glimpse these teeth. They will change everything we think we know about these animals. And much as I hesitate to say such a thing, man becomes smaller when we realize what remarkable beasts went before us. Johnson saw then that all that was done in Cope's mission, all that even he, Johnson, did now, would have meaning to scientists in the future. Now, your camera, Cope reminded him. We must record this moment and place. Johnson went off to collect his equipment from the flat plains above. When he returned, careful not to fall, Cope was still shaking his head. Of course you can't be sure from teeth alone, he said. Allometric factors may be misleading. How big do you make it? Johnson asked. He glanced at the sketchpad, now covered with calculations, some scratched out and done again. 75? Possibly 100 feet long, with a head perhaps 30 feet above the ground. And right there he gave it the name Brontosaurus, thundering lizard, because it must have thundered when it walked. But perhaps, he said, I should call it Apatosaurus, or unreal lizard, because it is hard to believe such a thing ever existed. Johnson took several plates, up close and from farther away, with Cope in all of them. They hurried back to camp, told the others of their discovery, and then, in the fading twilight, paced out the dimensions of Brontosaurus, a creature as long as 3 horse-drawn wagons and as tall as a 4-story building. It made the imagination run wild. It was altogether astonishing,
and Cope announced that this discovery alone justifies our entire time in the West, and that they had made a momentous discovery in these teeth. These are, Cope said, the teeth of dragons. The trouble the teeth would soon cause them, they could not have imagined. Around the Campfire. Any discovery led Cope to wax philosophical around the campfire at night. Each man had examined the teeth, felt their ridges and knobs, weighed their heft in one hand. The discovery of the gigantic Brontosaurus provoked an unusual degree of speculation. "There are so many things in nature we would never imagine," Cope said. "At the time of this Brontosaurus, the glacial ice had receded, and our entire planet was tropical. There were fig trees in Greenland, palm trees in Alaska. The vast plains of America were then vast lakes, and where we are sitting now was at the bottom of a lake. The animals we find were preserved because they died and sank to the bottom of the lake, where muddy sediment silted over them, and that sediment in turn compressed into rock. But who would have conceived such things until the evidence for them was found?" No one spoke. They stared at the crackling fire. "I am 36 years old. But at the time I was born," Cope said, "dinosaurs were unknown. All the generations of mankind had been born and died, lived and inhabited the earth, and none ever suspected that long, long before them, life on our planet was dominated by a race of gigantic reptilian creatures who held sway for millions upon millions of years." George Morton coughed. "If this is so, then what about man?" There was an uncomfortable silence. Most discussions of evolution sidestepped the question of man. Darwin himself had not dealt with man for more than a decade after his book was published. "You know of the German finds in the Neander Valley?" Cope asked. "No?" "Well, back in 56, they discovered a complete skull in Germany, heavy-boned, with brutish brow ridges. The strata is disputed, but it seems to be very old. I myself saw the find in Europe in 63. "I heard the Neander skull was an ape, or a degenerate," Sternberg said. "That is unlikely," Cope said. "Professor Venn in Dusseldorf has devised a new method of measuring the brain size of skulls. It's quite simple. He fills the brain case with mustard seeds, then pours the seeds out into a measuring vessel. His researches show that the Neander skull held a larger brain than we possess today." "You are saying this Neander skull is human?" Morton said. "I don't know," Cope said. "But I do not see how one can believe that dinosaurs evolved, and reptiles evolved, and mammals such as the horse evolved, but that man sprang fully developed without antecedents. Aren't you a Quaker, Professor Cope?" Cope's ideas were still unacceptable to most faiths, including the Religious Society of Friends, which was the Quaker's formal name. "I may not be," Cope said. "Religion explains what man cannot explain. But when I see something before my eyes, and my religion hastens to assure me that I am mistaken, that I do not see it at all, no, I may no longer be a Quaker after all." Leaving the Badlands. The morning of August 26th was distinctly chilly as they set out on the one-day journey to Cowl Island, located at one of the few natural fords along a 200-mile stretch of the Missouri River, where the Missouri Breaks formed a barrier on each side. The island also served as a steamboat landing, and it was here Cope planned to meet the steamboat that came up from St. Louis. They were all eager to leave, and frankly worried about Indians, but they had too many fossils to take with them in the wagon. Nothing would do but to make two trips. Cope marked the most precious box, the one with the Brontosaurus teeth,
with a subtle X on one side.
I'm going to leave this one here, Cope said, for the second